It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics, including news that Governor Scott Walker is again leading the pack in the latest poll in Iowa. First, we're looking at news just out from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. After months of speculation, the agency announced its new estimates, indicating that there would be no additional revenue for the state of Wisconsin over the next 2 years. Sean Johnson is with us to put this news into context and explain how this will affect the budget process. He's WPR State Capitol reporter. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Legislative Fiscal Bureau says no revenue hikes for the state of Wisconsin for the next 2 years. Is this what lawmakers expected?
Well, what they were hoping for is that the Fiscal Bureau would be telling them today that we expect the revenues will grow faster than expected. The numbers that we gave you back in January upon which this budget was built, those were wrong, and here we are today in May, and things are better. That is not what the Fiscal Bureau said. The Fiscal Bureau basically said we were right before, and so that means there is some revenue growth in this fiscal year and in the next fiscal year, and it's not like the state economy is completely stagnant, but what it means is there's not this new pot of money that will help legislators easily reduce cuts to education or the UW that they'd been hoping for. So they've either got to swallow those cuts or, find some kind of a tax increase to offset them, or find creative ways of budgeting that would help offset the cuts. And that may be the way that they go.
We talked yesterday a bit about how Governor Scott Walker seems to have tempered his expectations for higher revenues in the lead up to this announcement that we now have today. Given that, looking back, does it seem clear that maybe he knew these numbers were not going to come up as expected or as hoped?
Well, he, has access to his Department of Revenue, which is who knows the state's actual tax collection numbers before anyone else. And so there was a lot riding this year on what the state had in actual tax collections from April. They've made a lot of changes to tax laws, changes to withholding laws, and all those factors made it harder to forecast revenues this year. So when the governor came out and said, maybe we won't have enough to reduce all the cuts, he was tempering expectations. But I think this memo is worse than pretty much every Republican was hoping for, because it basically says everything's flat. There's no extra money for anything. And so if you want to reduce cuts to education, which Republicans still say they do, at least with K-12 education, you're going to have to do something else. This is not going to save you.
Right. So talking about this something else, you mentioned available options at this point might be something like raising taxes, which doesn't seem terribly likely with the Republican legislature, or accounting measures. What do you think might be turned to as options at this point?
What they're talking about doing is basically changing the timing of when payments are made to the school levy tax credit. I've struggled with how to explain this conversationally when we talk here, Veronica, because, it's tricky, but they're not talking about raising taxes, and they're not talking about finding all this money for K-12 education by cutting spending somewhere else. It is, they are talking about changing the timing of when certain payments get made, possibly pushing a payment to the state school levy tax credit into the next budget. So the schools would still get the money, but it would time out differently for the state and not be, it would just be in a different fiscal year. So a low politically, not a lot of political pain. Schools might still be happy because they still get the money. But if you're a fan of good budgeting and want to reduce, the deficit based on generally accepted accounting principles, not such a good move.
Now, some agencies and lawmakers had been hoping, as we've been talking about, for increased revenue, which could mean maybe that they would have been able to restore some of those proposed cuts to education and the UW. So what does that mean for these cuts going forward now?
Well, all that the only cut that all Republicans have said they will absolutely reduce or get rid of is the cut to K-12 education. So the governor's budget would have cut K-12 education by $127 million in the first year of this two-year budget. And so this accounting trick that I was just trying not so well to describe to you there, that would mostly offset that cut. What you're not hearing Republican leaders say, you know, in unison at least, is that we want to reduce the cut to the University of Wisconsin. That's $300 million over the entire budget, and doing that, you know, that would be tricky. And they, at this point, are not sending strong signals that they're going to go there, meaning the UW is going to have to absorb some kind of a cut in this budget, if not the entire cut that the governor proposed.
We're talking right now with Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter. We're talking about news that there will be no revenue hikes for the state of Wisconsin for the next 2 years, according to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. And the Budget Committee is meeting right now with this budget writing process. What does it mean? What kind of impact will this news have had?
Well, they have put off a lot of the big decisions in the early going of the budget process, the Joint Finance Committee has, because they've been waiting for these numbers. They felt like basically we can't really build a budget until we know how much money we have to work with. And so their fingers were crossed that these estimates would come in and say, you actually have more money to work with. So their job would be a lot easier. Because that hasn't happened, they now have to, they know they have to, you know, make some of these cuts if they're not open to finding, you know, new revenue by, like, you know, delaying a manufacturer's tax credit or raising taxes somewhere else. But yeah, I guess the good news for them, if there is any, is that they haven't made a lot of the big decisions on the budget yet, so they don't have to go back and revisit those. So you're going to see them over the course of this month start to take votes on what exactly they're going to do with K-12 education, what exactly they're going to do with the University of Wisconsin, with transportation, where they don't like all the borrowing in the governor's budget. That's all ahead of them.
In your years covering politics, and in particular Wisconsin politics, have you seen an analogous situation to where we are now, where there is this budget hole and the numbers just don't come in as good as expected? So any idea what we could expect?
I would say most of the years that I've covered, it seems like the revenues aren't quite where people hoped. I mean, a lot of the Republicans that serve in the legislature right now have only been there for a few years. And so in their experience of serving the legislature, you wait for the new revenue to come in. And a lot of the time, the new revenue numbers are better than you expected. And so decisions get easier. But, you know, by and large, that hasn't really been the story. And so I think what was different this year is that Republicans were putting a lot of stock in their public comments into these revenue numbers and really downplaying the cuts in the governor's budget, just saying, we've got this new money coming around the corner. You know, that just didn't happen. It didn't materialize. And so the budget that was presented in January is still the one that they have to deal with now here in May.
Why is there so much volatility with these numbers? Why aren't they more reliable?
They're based on, and you know, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau that does these estimates for Wisconsin base it on a lot of the same data that goes to every state. They're based on global economic forecasts, national economic forecasts, and so there are a lot of factors that affect the global economy. Also, there's changes to the way we collect taxes in Wisconsin, or, you know, the way that a tax credit is applied. For example, there's a really expensive one for manufacturing that's based on how corporations report their profit, which fluctuates a great deal. So it's a tricky business estimating revenues. I think if you look at the Fiscal Bureau's track record based on, you know, how close they get to the mark, it's never off by a lot in percentage terms. But because the state of Wisconsin skates so close to running, a zero balance every fiscal year, they can't afford the Fiscal Bureau to be wrong. And you know, they cut it close almost every budget. And so this, you know, this year is no change in that regard.
All right, Sean, thanks for getting us up to speed.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter. He was with us to break down the news that there will be no revenue hikes for the state of Wisconsin for the next 2 years. Scott Walker has a strong lead in the latest Iowa poll. Hillary Clinton went bold on immigration yesterday, and Republicans in the Senate just passed the first joint budget resolution in more than 5 years. It's time for a weekly look at the latest in national politics. Joining us today is Francesca Chambers, political reporter at the Daily Mail. Francesca, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker still leading the pack, according to the latest Iowa poll. Does this seem to say to you that maybe he's got some staying power?
Absolutely. It's not just this poll. He has been consistently leading the polls in this state since he made a breakout speech in Iowa earlier this year. And so I think that the rest of the Republican field has a lot of catching up to do, as he's already locked up nearly a quarter of likely Republican caucus goers in that state. And it's, I mean, still pretty early, but his favorables are very, very high.
Now, it's worth pointing out that the governor hasn't even announced that he's running for president yet. We're everyone's assuming that he is, but is there anything unusual in this scenario?
Well, you know, I don't think it is considerably that he has, you know, already built up a campaign apparatus and hired a lot of staff. So I don't think that at this point that we have to worry about him not running. I think he's definitely running, whereas some of the other governors potentially might not be running. They haven't taken as many steps to build up a campaign as he has.
So what do you think he's waiting for?
Well, I think that you don't want to announce at the same time as everybody else's. Obviously, a whole slate of other Republicans have announced recently. I think that also you start to put a target on your back by being an actual candidate versus a presumed candidate. And I think he's waiting as long as possible. But I don't think that any of the presumed or expected candidates are going to be able to wait too much longer, because they start running into possible campaign finance violations at this point by the fact that everybody knows that they're running for president, yet they continue to work with political action groups that they shouldn't be working with if they are an actual candidate.
So we said Governor Scott Walker at the top of this latest Iowa poll. How does the rest of the Republican pack look?
Well, I think one of the most surprising statistics that I saw in this poll was that Jeb Bush is only getting 5% of likely Republican caucus goers. And, you know, one argument that's been made for him is that his last name is a huge problem. Potentially being affiliated with the Bush family name could hurt him. But in this poll, actually, what you see is that 80% of the same likely Republican caucus goers say very nice things about his father and say nice things about his brother. So in this particular instance, it's not that they have a negative opinion of the other members of the Bush family who have been president. So it shows that he might be having other problems. Maybe they just don't like him.
So in terms of significance, is this pretty bad news for Jeb Bush, that he's further down the list there?
Well, he's only been to Iowa once this year, and it's the first time that he had been into Iowa in many years. So I think that one of the things that he would really have to do is just go back to Iowa and actually show his face to voters, give them an opportunity to meet him and get to like him. He could change some minds if he wanted to, but I think this poll might serve as a wake-up to his campaign that they need to start doing that aggressively and very soon before Scott Walker does run away with it.
Well, just to put this in perspective, how predictive is a win in Iowa on a future win in the final election?
Well, that is a good point. A lot of candidates who went to win Iowa don't go on to win the general election or even the Republican primary for that matter. Last time it was Rick Santorum who won Iowa technically after a recount, and we all know that he did not end up being the Republican nominee. So it's not all important to win Iowa per se. However, candidates would need to win at least Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina or Nevada, you know, the early primary states, in order to get the kind of momentum that they would need. So if Jeb Bush can't win Iowa, then he absolutely has to win one of those other states.
We're catching up on national politics right now with Francesca Chambers, a political reporter at the Daily Mail. And also in presidential election news, Hillary Clinton spoke in Nevada yesterday and came out strong on immigration. Here's what she had to say.
We can't wait any longer for a path to full and equal citizenship. Now, this is where I differ with everybody on the Republican side. Make no mistakes. Today, not a single Republican candidate, announced or potential, is clearly and consistently supporting a path to citizenship. Not one. When they talk about legal status, that is code for second-class status.
A bold announcement from Hillary Clinton yesterday. How do you frame what she just said there?
Well, you know, there's an interesting debate actually going on at the White House today, because I'm also the Daily Mail's White House correspondent, about whether or not, as president, if she were elected president, there is anything more she could even legally do that President Obama did not already do. She said yesterday that she would potentially go further than he went if Congress was unwilling to act. But whether or not she could legally go further is highly debatable.
And there's another question that some people have been talking about. Is it absolutely true that she's the only candidate supporting a path to citizenship like this?
Well, I will say that a lot of the Republicans have been a little bit skittish to put their opinion out there on the issue, because they risk isolating Hispanics by saying that they do not support a pathway to citizenship. At the same time, they risk isolating conservatives that they need to get them through the primary, the general election, to even be worried about the Hispanic general population if they say that they support a pathway to citizenship. And so I will say that she clearly has taken, I think, the most aggressive and boldest stance on the issue. But that's not to say that there aren't other Republicans running who may support some sort of a pathway to citizenship. For instance, Marco Rubio, he is one of the original Gang of Eight in the Senate. You know, he supported originally a pathway to citizenship. And while he has backed away from that a little bit, I think it still stands that he would be one of the Republican candidates that would be willing to do the most on immigration.
Do you see the issue of immigration being a challenge for Republican candidates?
Yes, I do think it is very much of a challenge for Republican candidates for the reasons that I just stated before, because, you know, they cannot risk isolating conservatives who are very much against that pathway to citizenship if they want to win in those states like Iowa, you know, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. They need to get that momentum. But certainly, if they come out too strongly against it, then they can't win the general election either, because Hispanics make up such a growing portion of the general electorate.
Well, moving on, yesterday the Senate passed its first joint budget resolution in more than 5 years. First off, what is a joint budget resolution?
I know, it's all very confusing. Basically, Republicans in the Senate and Republicans in the Senate in the House came together and they agreed on a blueprint, so to speak, that will basically serve as guidelines for all these appropriation bills that they're going to try to pass in this session of Congress. And it really has absolutely no binding or legal status at all. It won't go to the White House. It won't go to the president. Again, it's just a blueprint for the bills and the appropriations that they're going to do in the future.
And yet some Republican leaders saying, you know, we know that it's not binding and then the president would veto what we put forward anyway, but we're going to go forward with it in good faith because we passed it. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that Republicans are trying to differentiate themselves from Democrats. When Democrats were in charge of the Senate, they didn't pass the budget at all. And so I think that they're just trying to show that they have stronger leadership than Democrats and that they'll stick to their principles, even if they're unpopular, and they'll stand up to the president because they feel that that's what they were elected to do in November, to be a check on the president's power.
Now, is this the kind of thing that would appeal to the Republican base? Although it is non-binding, will Republican voters look at this and will approval ratings go up?
Well, I don't know that the approval ratings will go up, because as we just talked about, the budget's very complicated, it's non-binding, and not all of the topics that are in it are the ones that I like to call sexy per se. But at the same time, I do think that this is something that Republicans will be able to point to and say, we're getting things done in Congress, we are passing legislation, as I think the Republicans like to say this session, we're putting, you know, Congress back to work.
And finally, you know, last week on this show, we spoke to Senator Ron Johnson about his priorities for a deal with Iran and about the amendment process in the Senate for a bill that would give Congress a final say in that deal. Where does that bill stand now?
Well, there is about to be a vote on that deal, and it would appear that because Senate Majority Leader McConnell has essentially stifled debate on some of the amendments that would scuttle the deal, that it will move forward in the Senate, and it therefore will move forward in the House as well, because Republicans have even more seats, you know, in the House than they do percentage-wise in the Senate. And the White House has said that as long as there are no egregious amendments, that they will not veto this bill. So it looks as if Congress will get to have a say in the Iran deal.
Francesca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
That was Francesca Chambers, political reporter at the Daily Mail. We dig into the latest in national politics every week at this time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back with me tomorrow. Some new data analysis is giving us some food for thought when it comes to music and pop culture, suggesting that as we age, we lose interest in discovering new music and exploring bands and songs and genres that expand our musical horizons. That's according to a researcher who broke down data from the music service Spotify. The turning point, according to the study, age 33. That's when users appear to stop checking out new music of the day, instead going back to the music of their glory days, of the teens and 20s. This is not peer-reviewed public science, but a great conversation starter. Our next guest has been thinking about these issues for a long time now. Stephen Hayden is a music writer based here in Wisconsin. He's a staff writer at Grantland. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, you wrote about this 4 years ago when you were at this turning point age, the age of 33. What do you think changes in our musical lives in our early 30s that we start to get kind of fossilized?
Well, I think there's a number of factors that happen. I mean, if you compare music to movies or television, music is so much more vast than those areas. You know, music is changing all the time. There's so many artists. It just takes a lot more work to keep up with popular music. So, you know, as you enter your 30s, your life gets fuller. You know, you get married, you have kids, you have a mortgage, and you don't have the free time necessarily to keep up with music. I also think that there's something about music that people use when they're teenagers to form their identities. You know, like when you're a teenager, a lot of times, if you get into a certain genre or a certain band, that becomes a big part of who you are, and it's how you define yourself. So, like, if you're into punk rock, for instance, you know, you see yourself as a punk, and you define yourself against what, you know, punk is supposed to be against. And it's interesting how that sense of identity doesn't necessarily change as you get older. You know, like, you still hold on to that, even when you're no longer a kid. So I think sometimes people, you know, they have these sort of entrenched biases that they take from, you know, their teen years and their 20s, and when they get older, they don't want to let it go. And it's such a part of who they are that, like, taking in something that's new can be really difficult.
But then why wouldn't people just keep following that particular genre? Say, if you like punk music, you keep up on whatever bands sound like they're the latest in punk music and follow the thread along, like you might, say, I don't know, with a kind of movie or a book. What's different about music?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, that does make sense that you would just follow the genre as it develops over the years. But, you know,
Stephen, are you still with us? And it looks like we lost Stephen. We're going to try to reconnect with him right now. And in the meantime, we're curious about what you think about this. Does this sound like you? Did you hit, say, around age 33 and then decide you were kind of done listening to new music, looking for new music, hunting it down, and you set your musical preferences? You're still listening to the stuff from your 20s or your teens, for that matter. Call us and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. And Stephen is back with us now. Stephen, you were talking about why it might be that we don't keep just following a particular genre of music.
Yeah, as I was saying, it's interesting because, you know, like when I was growing up, you know, we would always have to deal with our parents telling us that, like, the music that we loved wasn't as good as the music that they grew up with. And, you know, when you're a kid, you always think, well, I'm never going to be that closed-minded when I become an adult. And yet now that, you know, I'm in my 30s and I you know, see friends of mine who now have kids, you know, they go through they're saying the same thing. You know, they're talking about music that they grew up in the 90s being better than music now. And I think part of that is that, you know, as you get older, you have a longer perspective on music. You know, like, it's not like when you're a kid and, like for instance, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, like, when you hear Nirvana for the first time, that might be the first type of band like that you ever heard. So then they sound revolutionary because your frame of reference is so much more limited. But then 20 years after that, you've heard lots of music. You have a much, you know, you're much more educated in a way. So things don't sound as fresh. And anything that's newer, I think, tends to sound derivative sometimes to people who are older. So you end up, you know, in a situation where, like, you have old people saying, well, this new band is just a ripoff of something that I liked 20 years ago, and which is the same thing that our parents said when we were kids. So I think for some reason it's just harder for people to hear, I guess, the nuances and what's new now. You know, there just seems to be this impulse for people when they get older to dismiss things as just being rehashed, you know, and things were better when they were younger.
Well, do you think there's anything to that argument before we totally dismiss it, that maybe pop culture is sort of evolutionary in a sense, and the weak get winnowed out and the things that are the best get distilled and brought forward, and maybe it's sort of a narrowing tip of a pyramid in terms of goodness when it comes to music?
I mean, I think that's definitely true. I think that things do get rehashed, and obviously, you know, every new band that comes along has influences, and they're going to start out early in their careers by, like, sort of emulating their influences and trying to reach, you know, what their heroes did. I think where the fallacy comes in is the belief that, like, when you were younger, things were original, and now they're rehashed. The fact is that when you were a kid, things were also rehashed. It's just that you didn't know it. You thought that this was something fresh and new. I mean, but that's just what art is. Art is a continuum, you know, like, especially music. It's a set of sounds and attitudes and lyrics and all that kind of stuff that gets passed down. And the more that you know about music, the more you can see that. And I think that's kind of fascinating, personally. Like, I love having that perspective of, like, you know, having heard stuff from 20 years ago and then comparing it to stuff that comes out now and seeing what gets changed and what remains the same and what gets carried forward and just kind of experiencing that continuum, you know, rather than being turned off by it.
And do you think we might also see music from our 20s as the best of our life because we're young then? Maybe we're at peak happiness when we're our 20s and, I guess, early 30s.
Well, absolutely. I definitely think, you know, when we talk about memory, like, music is, like, one of the strongest sort of catalysts for how we remember the past. You know, it's like the old cliche about hearing a song on the radio and remembering everything about your life the first time you heard it. You know, I mean, there's countless examples of that. And I think certainly, you know, as you get older and, you know, your life is maybe not as carefree as it once was, you know, like in your teens and 20s, if you're hearing songs from that era, you know, it might be a form of escapism for you, you know, to relive that. And I think that's totally fine. I think that's one of the great things about music, the sort of way that it can transport you out of your body to, like, different times in your life. I think where it becomes a problem is, like, when you maybe get a little closed off from the world and only live in the past, when, in fact, you know, there's a lot of good things that are happening in the present.
I'm talking right now to music critic Stephen Hayden about the way our attitudes toward music change over time. Recent articles suggesting that a lot of us sort of fossilize at the age of 33 and we stop listening to new music and we just keep on listening to the music sort of our youth, of our 20s and teens and the early 30s. What about that? Is this you? Does it sound like you? Are you someone who keeps searching for new music no matter what your age is? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go now to Joe joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I listen to all sorts of music largely because I teach at the university and I have a lab that I have a lot of college students in, and they're allowed to bring in whatever music they want or listen to whatever music they want, which exposes me to the current music, but they have to listen to what I listen to as well, which exposes them to what I used to listen to. And I think things like Pandora are great because you put in something that you like, and then it starts playing similar things that expose you to a whole bunch of music.
Great. Well, thanks for that, Joe. A bit of cross-pollination is good for everybody, Joe is saying. Do you think it works that way, Stephen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the way, that streaming works now, I mean, it's easier than ever to discover new music. I mean, if you have, access to Pandora or you have a Spotify account, I mean, to subscribe to these services, it's a pretty nominal fee, like maybe $10 a month. Or you can go on YouTube, as many people do, and sample music there. And, all these streaming devices have some sort of discovery function where, like the guy who just called said that, if you like a certain artist, it'll suggest other artists who sound similar. If you go on Spotify, there's a similar thing on there as well. There's also, easy ways to find new releases on there. There's usually a social media aspect to a lot of these services, so you can see what your friends are listening to. If you do have a friend that still listens to new music, that's usually a great way to find out about new artists.
Let's get in one more quick call here. Alec is with us from Maquanago. Hi, Alec.
Hi. So I had read this article. I actually shared it with my girlfriend online, and I begged her. I said, please don't let us be these people because we're 31 and 33 respectively now.
You're right there.
Yep, we're right there. And I think that's probably true for a broad segment of people, that they stop listening to different types of music. But I think there's a huge section of people that also really pride themselves on getting to know new music. And I know the article is really mainly talking about, like pop music. No people who are going to be over 33 are going to listen to the new Ariana Grande album. But it doesn't mean they're not going to discover stuff that they didn't have an opportunity to listen to when they were younger, like really older jazz or like classical music. Because, following the genres as they evolve, the genres change so much. Punk isn't what it used to be when it started. Jazz has essentially stopped at like fusion and Latin jazz. So it's really tough to evolve. But also I think there's a lot of people who will hearken back to stuff that, they didn't know back in the day, and they'll discover stuff that was loved by other generations,
Great point. Thank you for that, Alec. And that's definitely me. I don't always listen to what's on the radio or new stuff, but, I discovered Wilco about 5 years ago. Probably everyone else in the world knew about Wilco. But what about finding bands and music that's new to you, but, maybe older?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about music. We talked earlier about how vast music is and how that can be intimidating, but the great thing about that is that, as many great TV shows as there are right now, it's a fairly limited thing. There's only so many shows that are as great as The Wire or The Sopranos or whatever, but there are so many, there's so many galaxies of music out there just waiting to be explored, If you've never listened to jazz, think of how many great eras of jazz there are, or how many great eras of folk music there are, or just pick any genre. And again, that music is more accessible now than it's ever been, probably ever, So yeah, it's just waiting
for you to dive in.
We're talking right now to music critic Stephen Hayden about how we listen to music may change over time. Our conversation today in response to a recent article that suggests a lot of us stop listening and searching out new music around the age of 33. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? If you're in your 30s or beyond, do you prefer the music that you grew up with? Do you think of it as sort of comfort music, the music of your teens and your 20s? Or are you still seeking out the cool new stuff? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Stephen Hayden, music critic and staff writer for Grantland. According to a recent analysis of music data from the website Spotify, a lot of us stop listening to new music and go back to the music of our teens and 20s starting around the age of 33. Not true totally for Rob Ferret, my co-host. This is a song I Sat by the Ocean by Queens of the Stone Age. Apparently this was Rob's jam for 2 years. He made an effort to get out there and look for new music. And we want to hear your story. Do you have a problem with music these days? Do you have a cutoff date for the music you listen to? Do you go back to those old comforting tracks from your teens, your 20s, your early 30s? Or do you go out there and look for new music? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go now to, how about a Facebook comment here from John in Annapolis, who says, at age 57, I'm always on the lookout for new music. On my Android phone, Shazam is by far the most used app. I stumble across new music through radio stations, TV shows, movies, internet clips, YouTube videos. A lot of these discoveries, he says, lead to purchases, sometimes a single track and sometimes a full CD. So, Stephen, is that a good tool for people to explore the new world of music if they're getting stuck?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as the music industry has evolved, or some would say devolved, oftentimes the best way to get songs out there are through commercials or through television shows, where you don't necessarily know like who the artist is or what the song title is. So like having something like Shazam is a great way to discover new artists, because you know that is often now how artists get exposed. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea.
We're gonna go back to the phones now. We've got Christine joining us from Appleton. Hi, Christine.
Hello, I'm 51, and I'm constantly looking out for new music. I actually get a lot of new music ideas from the New York Times. And so a good example is I have tickets to see Belle and Sebastian and Courtney Barnett. So I've been listening to Belle and Sebastian since I was in my 30s, and Courtney Barnett, the new artist that I really loved. And so I just think music is constantly evolving, and there's constantly good stuff.
Christine, does it take you a long time to search out that new music? That's an obstacle for some people, including me, is that you really have to sometimes go digging. Do you find it to be time-consuming?
Not really. I mean, I'm serious, and so there's a sort of a new music alternative station, and so there's constantly new music on there. And the Sunday New York Times has been great. I find a lot of good artists there.
Great. Well, thanks, Christine. Appreciate your thoughts. And Stephen, she goes to the New York Times, also Sirius, Spotify, Pandora. What do you recommend for finding new music?
Well, first off, I just want to second the Courtney Barnett recommendation. She made one of my favorite records of the year. I actually wrote a profile of her about her for Grantland, where I write, so I would recommend Grantland as a place to go. I have to plug my own site. I think really now, the New York Times, they have great music coverage. I think, social media is really another really great place to find out about new music, because, people, along with sharing everything else in their lives, they're constantly sharing like what they're listening to on Spotify or on any number of streaming services. And for as long as there's been music, like the best way to discover new artists is usually from recommendations that you get from your friends, and that is the best way, I think, to get it now. So if it's something you're interested in,
you know, like the caller just said, it doesn't take that much work to find new artists that you might be into.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Jack calling from Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Jack.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I'm more than double this cutoff age that you guys are talking about. Uh-huh. And I have been able to find new music because I got a subscription to a satellite radio. I'm too lazy to look in the New York Times and look stuff up. So I just listen. I make it a habit to go to a different station every other day or so just to see what's on. I had everything from all the classics that I like to Katy Perry to reggae to the down-home country boys at the Bean Blossom. So and it's exciting for me because I think, like you guys said before, there's the same thing over and over again, but it's done differently each time, and it makes it exciting and it makes it fun to listen to.
Great place to leave it. Thank you, Jack. Jack is obviously an omnivore when it comes to his music. And just briefly, Stephen, as we wrap up, what encouragement would you give people to look for new music?
Yeah, I would just say that the attachment that you have to the records that you grew up with, you know, that's great and it's sacred, and I wouldn't discourage anyone from, like, revisiting music that they grew up loving. But I would just say that it's not as if you can't still have those connections with new songs. You know, if you think about how great those songs that you grew up with, you know, you can form those kind of relationships with songs now. So then when you're older than you are now, you can look back on this part of your life as being, you know, sort of a magical time, and that these artists kind of evoke that period. I mean, music
Stephen,
really
thank
is.
You so much. We're going to leave it there. That was Stephen Hayden, a Wisconsin-based music critic and staff writer at Grantland. You can keep the conversation going at the Central Time Facebook page. Today marks the 100th birth anniversary of Wisconsin's own Orson Welles. Welles was an actor, director, writer, and the guy responsible for War of the Worlds and what's arguably the best film of all time, Citizen Kane. Welles was born in Kenosha, which is something to be proud of, even if it turns out he kind of hated Kenosha. But we can't feel too bad about that. After all, this is a guy who said, "I always have to be bigger than life. It's a fault in my nature." Just today, the distributor Rialto announced that they're releasing a restored version of the film The Third Man, starring Orson Welles. It'll premiere this month at the Cannes Film Festival. Right now, we leave you with a touch of Orson.
Hey, where's that shadow fella the newspapers talk about?
I am more than just a voice, Anton Spivak. I am the shadow.
You're the shadow?
Yes.
Where are you hiding?
I am hiding under the cloak of invisibility. You cannot see me because I have clouded your mind. So you cannot see that which is here.
Orson Welles there on his birth anniversary.